Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to NASA's Johnson Space Center. We are here today for our combined mission status briefing and our post-mission management team briefing. Joining us today is Brian Lunny. He is Space Shuttle Discovery's lead flight director throughout the mission of the orbiter to the International Space Station. And also joining us is Leroy Kane. He's the deputy manager of the Space Shuttle program, and he's also the chair of the mission management team as well. We'll hear from both gentlemen, and then we'll take questions here and at other NASA centers. And with that, I'll turn it over to Brian.
Okay. Thank you, Kyle. I'll just start off with a quick summary of some of the things that went on today on orbit and how the crew is doing. The crew woke up just before 6 o'clock Houston time, and they were doing a great job up there. Listening to them, they sound like they're having a really good time as well. Things are perking along just as we would all hope. From an activity standpoint, this morning we went and performed our second phasing rendezvous phasing burn, and that was about a 10-foot per second right ohms burn. That is just setting us up for a rendezvous tomorrow. Tonight we'll do one more of those rendezvous phasing burns. That one's a little bit smaller at about 6 feet per second. Currently we're phasing in on the International Space Station. We're about 7,600 nautical miles behind the ISS, and of course we'll get there tomorrow. For today, Steve Lindsay, Eric Bowe, and Al Drew, they performed the Flight Day 2 inspection. They've completed so far the starboard and the nose cap surveys, and we're working on the port survey when I came over here. All is going really well. The systems are behaving just well, just fine with that, and we expect to get that all wrapped up shortly and get the orbiter boom sensor system put away for tonight and all ready for docking tomorrow. During this time period, the other folks, Steve Bowen, Mike Barrett, and Nicole Stott, they continue to configure Discovery for orbit ops by setting up the ergometer, the little bicycle that they use for exercise. They activated the National Laboratory program samples. They're taking some orbit photos and some surveys for us with photos, and they're checking out their spacesuits for our spacewalks on Flight Days 5 and Flight Day 7. Later today, they'll continue with those preps by installing the centerline camera, which is, of course, the camera we use to when we rendezvous to align the Discovery with the International Space Station. And they're checking out the rendezvous tools and docking systems and configuring the airlock for tomorrow's docking. All in all those activities, everything's going really well on board. The plan is in good shape, and the crew's executing it quite well. Discovery, it's, from a system standpoint, is doing fantastic. The vehicle's in great shape. I don't even have any notable anomalies to talk to you about. So everything's going well there, and we're ready for our rendezvous tomorrow. So that's all I got.
Leroy.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Well, good afternoon. It is it's great to be here with you today. It's always really good to be back on orbit. I think in this case, it's especially prideful for us. I think a couple of reasons for that, not the least of which is no doubt that this is a big milestone for Discovery and for the shuttle team as a whole. And so it's great to see her back in orbit and performing the way she is. Also, I think because, and I know you've been briefed quite a bit before launch on all the work that took place with the external tank and the various challenges that we had as a program going back to late October and early November. I know some of those briefings went into some great detail on the work that the team performed and what was necessary to get us back to a flying condition again. I don't think in those forums or in this one I can really do justice in terms of what I want to say about the team's effort in that regard. As a shuttle program management team, I can tell you that we couldn't be more proud of what the team was able to accomplish. The dedication that the team showed to a person across the country, across the various centers, the sheer perseverance of the team members, and their commitment to excellence. We've seen this kind of thing as we've tackled other problems going through the program, in this case, I think it was extra special because. We had some other challenges that we haven't faced before in the program, and to include a smaller workforce and some pressures on folks, both in their personal and professional life that we probably didn't face before. But these folks, it was amazing to watch them work, and it's no doubt another reason, as I said, why it's extra special for us to be in orbit again with Discovery. So I can't say enough about the team's performance. It was just exemplary overall, and it really is hard to describe, and really hard, as I said, in a forum like this, to really give you a full appreciation of what it means to us and what it really took to get to the point where we could light the solids and have the liftoff and the launch of Discovery that we had yesterday. So just a great day to be part of the space program, a great day to be part of this team. So I'm extremely proud of the team. The launch and the ascent went extremely well. It was a beautiful launch. And ET-137, the external tank, had excellent performance. Again, a testament to the team's work the past several months in particular. As Brian mentioned, Discovery's performance on orbit has been outstanding. We had very, very few minor kinds of systems items to even talk about, and nothing of significance. We're looking forward to the rendezvous and the docking tomorrow. We have a very full and exciting mission with the space station, and the team is ready to go. At the MMT today, we really didn't have a whole lot to talk about. We did review some very preliminary images from ascent. We have, and I think we have a couple of images with us today, Kyle, that we can show. One that you no doubt have heard about. This is, I believe it was a 231-second event. We had a piece of foam that liberated from the external tank. This area here is on the lower part of the inner tank area. It's actually the majority of this debris liberation is just a little bit above the LH2 flange area that you heard us talk quite a bit about in the last several months. The foam liberated at a time when it's relatively late in the profile. It's certainly well past our time of concern for foam liberation. Nevertheless, this piece liberated, and then I think we have another slide that shows sort of the trajectory of the piece. If you get your bearings in this photo here, the lower left corner of the picture is the actual feed line on the tank, and then the yellow line and the red lines are intended to indicate the trajectory of the foam piece. It took sort of a random path where it initially floated up. Looks like it may have touched the underside of the orbiter there in the bipod attach region, maybe somewhere around the arrowhead region, and then from there it went and traveled back along the stack, and doesn't appear to have impacted any other part of the orbiter or the shuttle system as it made its way into the plume. So that was an item of interest during ascent. This, I'll remind you, this is in an area where we know we have susceptibility to what we call cryopumping, where that part of it, that's at the very top of the liquid hydrogen tank. And so when we get to this 3 or 4 minute time period in ascent, that part of the tank is getting relatively warm compared to what it had been. And so we get this cryopumping. And from a physics standpoint and a post-flight historical and a test standpoint going back to return to flight, we know we can lose foam as a result of this cryopumping phenomenon. So that was, we believe, preliminarily that was the cause of this foam loss. And so not totally unexpected. This is a portion, an area of the tank that we're very attuned to in terms of the potential for this kind of debris loss. So we don't have any concerns about this event. Obviously, we'll do our normal vehicle inspections, and in fact, they are ongoing today and tomorrow as we approach the space station, and we'll do all of our normal inspection work to make sure that the vehicle is okay. But that was one foam event that I thought we would show you today. There were a couple of other events during ascent. They were as well outside of the area of aerodynamic sensitive transport time, and so We didn't see anything of concern in terms of debris loss from the tank. And as I mentioned earlier, overall the performance of this tank, external tank number 137, was really exceptional. So from a preliminary standpoint, things look really good for all of the space shuttle elements, and certainly Discovery is performing very, very well on orbit, and the crew is well on their way to getting into the mission in earnest. And so we look forward to rendezvous and docking tomorrow, and the crew and the ground, and the teams on the ground are ready to go. So that's all I have. I'd be happy to take your questions.
Okay, thanks, gentlemen. We'll start here, of course, and then check with the other NASA centers and out on the phone bridge. Please give your name and affiliation for those following along with the briefing. Jeremiah, we'll start with Mark.
Hey, thanks. Mark Caro for Aviation Week, and I think this is for Leroy, but on the LH2 flange foam loss and debris trajectory you talked about, is that something you would see in the photography during the backflip tomorrow, or is that something you have to catch another way in terms of whether there was impact damage?
Certainly, we would fully expect to see any kind of damage in that area that I showed you in the photo there, that one still shot. The area of what I would call closest approach, if it did in fact touch the bottom of the orbiter, would have been in that arrowhead region where the bipod attaches to the underside of the orbiter, up in the landing gear, the forward landing gear door area. So we expect, as we have in the past, we would get very good imagery of that entire area during the RPM maneuver tomorrow during the rendezvous.
Anything else, Mark?
Yeah, Jim, right across. Ross with NASASpaceflight.com. For Leroy, could you just provide a status on the SRB recovery?
SRB recovery is on track as the same schedule as it was before we launched. So I think tomorrow we'll get a preliminary briefing, and they'll give us a good indication of when we expect to have the boosters in tow and in the port, in fact. So I'm looking to the Sunday, Monday time frame.
Thank you.
Anything else? Gina up front. Oh, grab Eric while you're there.
Eric Berger with the Houston Chronicle. Leroy, if you could kind of go over the status of the last two tanks for 134 and 135, talk about their disposition. Are they going to be fixed the same way ET-137 was? And does it give you sort of more confidence in these last two tanks considering the performance of this tank?
Yeah, we've essentially settled on a path that puts all of the tank essentially in the same configuration as what we flew here on ET-137. So ET-122, the tank that we have hanging in the integration cell right now, getting ready to mate to Endeavour, is the tank that will fly on STS-134, the April mission, and we made a decision a few weeks ago that the best approach for us would be to go with a configuration that we know, which is to put the radius blocks on the LO2 flange area on ET-122. And we anticipate we'll do the same thing for ET-138. So we will essentially plan to fly the last three tanks, to include the one we just launched and flew yesterday, ET-137, in the same configuration. It's one that prior to this flight, is the best data that we have relative to the lion's share of the test and analysis that we've done, and we have a high degree of confidence in the modification that we've done, and certainly it performed exceptionally on the tank we just flew, launched and flew yesterday. So that's our plan.
Go ahead.
Gina Sinceri, ABC News for Brian. What is the fly around, the Soyuz fly around, a done deal yet? If so, when would that happen for the photo op?
Sure. The discussion for the Soyuz fly around is something we looked at real closely for the last few weeks prior to flight. It's not a done deal yet. We're going to have my friends in the MMT and the IMMT discuss it further, and I've asked them to give us ops guys a decision no later than flight day 6. If they agree and ask us to go include that in the flight, then we're going to insert a day, and it'd be between flight day 9 and 10. So we would do the flyabout flight day on flight day 10 in the current schedule. If after MMT review and IMMT review, they conclude that we ought to go do that.
Right behind her.
Denise Chow, space.com. Question for Leroy. I know you said that the preliminary results show that the foam loss is not an issue, but because you saw that with the ET-137, is that going to change at all the modifications that you're doing for Endeavor and Atlantis' tanks?
No, in all likelihood it won't. I will, as we always do, reserve final judgment until we have thoroughly reviewed all of the data. What I've shown you today is preliminary. My assessment of it is also preliminary. What I would tell you that I have a pretty high degree of confidence that we're going to, in the end, determine that this was a cryopumping event, one that we know that we're susceptible to, one that we know that we have some level of accepted risk for, and one that we know that in this area of the LH2 flange, we've done an awful lot of work to ensure that we can minimize these kind of cryopumping events. If you recall, when we were having the discussions about ET-137, the tank we just flew, modified and flew, one of the areas that we emphasized was we were quite satisfied that we were able to develop flight rationale for the LH2, the stringer ends on the LH2 flange end of the inner tank, because we really didn't want to have to remove foam and modify those areas of the stringer ends. And part of the reason for that is because we have some very special processes that are done at the manufacturing plant where the LH2 flange closeout is concerned. The way we put the foam on, the methods and the techniques that we used for putting that foam on, you'll recall that we did a lot of analytical work and a lot of testing in the return to flight timeframe to wind up with the design and the implementation of that LH2 flange area that we fly today, and we really didn't want to disturb that because we know that we have some susceptibility with the cryopumping in that area. So I do not anticipate that what we've seen in terms of performance on this tank would cause us to want to do anything different in the area of the LH2 flange on the upcoming two tanks. That's preliminarily. In fact, I would say, contrary to that, I think we'll look at the performance of this tank once all the data is in, and it will confirm what we think today, which is that it performed exceptionally, and it reinforces the modifications that we did on the locks, the LO2 flange area. And so I think it'll reinforce the flight rationale that we established to go fly this mission.
Robert.
Hi, Robert Perlman with collectspace.com for Brian. Can you just give a preview of tomorrow's docking activities and talk a little bit about the Dragon Eye DTO that will be performed during that, as well as on the subject of visiting vehicles, if there's anything different about this docking, given that you do have HDV and ATV already there?
Okay. For tomorrow, the crew will wake up like any other day, and we're going to pick up with our what we call our Group P power up. We'll power up all the a couple extra computers and some other components on the vehicle to get ready to go execute the docking. And then we have two big burns planned, an altitude raising burn and another phasing burn, and then followed about a rev later by the TI burn, the terminal initiation burn for the rendezvous. As far as the rendezvous itself, it's a pretty straightforward rendezvous like many we have accomplished in the past. No special tasks or things going on for that. The vehicle's in great shape, crew's in great shape, so nothing extra special there. As far as Dragon Eye, it's a DTO we have on board. It's a box that sits by the orbiter docking system out in the payload bay. And the only interface we have with is a power switch, pretty much. We turn it on prior to we begin the rendezvous, and we turn it off once we get docked. And our insight and interface with it is limited. So hopefully we'll get to see the data, how it performs later as an agency, as a spaceflight community. But as far as during this flight, it's not going to do anything for us. We'll just power it on and power it off when we get done. So as far as the rendezvous, everything's nominal, and we expect everything to go just fine. And as far as anything different, because HTV and ATV are there, no, not really. We have them in our visuals. We see that they're there, and we're going to fly in. We did talk about powering on one of the cameras on the exposed facility on the Japanese side, and they may choose to do that and get some good video of the orbiter as it's approaching. We have said that they can do that if they like, and I think they were still contemplating that when I left earlier this afternoon.
Okay. Peter Spotts with the Christian Science Monitor for Mr. Kane. I wonder, for the rookie in the group, if you could describe a little bit this cryopumping, what causes it, what effect it has on the tank that would then lead to a shedding of foam.
Okay. Yeah. On the most basic level, from a physics level understanding, the air pockets in the system, that area of the tank is very cold. Before we launch, the tank is filled essentially up to nearly the top where that flange area is. So that whole surrounding area is very cold, to include the back face of the tank structure and the flange. And therefore the necessity of the insulation and the foam. As we proceed through launch and ascent, we use up that fuel at a pretty rapid pace, so the fuel level goes down in the tank, and so therefore that whole area that's vacated by that fuel tends to warm up, and therefore the structure around it warms up, the air warms up, and any air pockets that you have in the system tend to want to escape, because now they're warmer. When they do that, they sometimes push foam in the direction to include away from the surface of the tank and cause foam at whatever its weakest point is to pop off. That's fundamentally what's happening.
Okay, let's go and take some questions down at the Kennedy Space Center, the launch site in Florida.
Hello, this is Marcia Dunn of the Associated Press. Leroy, I have a couple foam questions, please. The chart that you showed had impact 1, 2, and 3, and I didn't know if those were three different pieces of foam potentially hitting at three different locations, or whether that was just – you just mentioned the one impact, so that's why I'm unclear.
Okay. Maybe I'll ask if we put the slide back up, and we can talk to it a little bit. It's really – it's to answer your question best, Marcia, it's really best to see this in motion, unfortunately, and I don't know if we have the ability to pull that up during this conference. We probably don't. We only saw one area that we think that the foam may have touched the underside of the orbiter, and that's in this area just in front of the bipod in the what I call the arrowhead region. The others are potential. You know, it says impact there's potential impact areas. I think there's less certainty in the other two. And because it is very preliminary, I'd probably be wouldn't be wise to say a whole lot more about it than that at this point. We'll, in the coming days, potentially have some more certainty on that. But we have to put some more time and some more assessment between now and then. But I think the one that we've feel, not the least of which reasons is because it caused the piece of foam to change direction significantly, is the first event. I think I probably would have chosen to change these labels and call it event 1, 2, and 3. But at any rate, I don't know that we have positively ascertained that all three of those areas that are marked there were quote-unquote impact events.
That helps clear it up. Thank you. And in any event, these three events, would they be different pieces of foam or the same one just sort of ricocheting around?
Piece.
I'm sorry, can you repeat? We didn't hear that.
It's the same piece as it's traveling down the length of the stack.
Great, thank you. And do you have, I know yesterday at the briefing it was said that there were at least four instances of foam loss. Is that still the best number to your to what you've seen so far?
That's correct. Four is the number that was mentioned in the MMT today. All of them were outside of the ASTT region that we of concern for, so relatively late events. And so as of today, it's four, to include this one that I showed you.
And when you say four, I'm taking that to mean four detectable pieces of foam that came off, or four events with multiple little pieces coming off. Could you clarify? And what was the biggest size that you think did come off of all the pieces?
Okay, so for the first part, four events, three of which I believe we think the source or the debris item itself is in all likelihood foam from the tank. I think there's a fourth event that we haven't been able to ascertain the source of it, and I'm not sure that it's tank foam. And again, all these items we'll have more on as we go throughout the course of the mission. This is all very preliminary. So those are separate and would be, we believe, based on what we know today, they would be separate events, separate sources of foam, if you will. I don't have a size, a dimension yet on the largest. I think the largest would be this 231-second event. I just don't, the guys just haven't given me dimensionally what size it is yet.
Okay, that's all from Florida. Let's see, I've got a couple of folks on the phone bridge. First up, James Dean with Florida Today.
Thank you very much. Leroy, just very quickly following up on what you just said, if the debris wasn't foam, would that be much more of a concern, even if it wasn't something that would have struck the shuttle with great velocity? I mean, what could it have been otherwise?
It could be any number of things. It would be pure speculation for me to say at this point. So, no, not a concern necessarily at all.
Okay, I just wanted to ask you that the inspection techniques discovery pioneered after Columbia, and particularly with the respect to the backflip that'll do tomorrow. I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about what you've learned from these maneuvers since they were implemented, and how important they've been to program moving forward over these past 6+ years.
Okay, sure. The suite of techniques and tools and inspection capability and analytical techniques, all of the work that we've done really in the return to flight and since return to flight, which we continue to evolve all the way up to including, you know, this mission, have been very, very important to us in terms of continuing to learn and understand the performance of this vehicle. So obviously the first few times we did some of those new procedures, the first few times we implemented some of those return to flight techniques to get inspection data, our learning curve was pretty steep, and we learned a lot about the performance of the vehicle. Along the way, as we continued to implement changes to the tank and we continued to tweak the system with our goal of having minimizing the amount of debris, the amount of foam coming off the tank, if you will, the procedures and the techniques have been as important all the way along, because in some cases they were used to verify that we did in fact solve a problem or help mitigate a problem by some modification that we did to a foam application technique, or something more significant than that we did on the tank to remove some of the foam ramps and some of the larger modifications that we did. So those things were not only important for determining the health of the vehicle once we got in orbit, which was hugely important to us, of course, but they were also important as it relates to moving forward and being in a continuous learning environment. So they substantiate some of the things we did along the way, in addition to, for that very mission where we did that inspection, they gave us the ability to move forward knowing that we had a vehicle that was safe to continue the mission and to return for deorbit and entry. And so I would tell you it'd be very difficult to go back and more than a year or two and find missions in that succession going all the way back to return to flight where we haven't continued to learn because of the return to flight inspection and analytical techniques that we put in place. So it's been very, very important to us and allowed us really to move forward with our eyes open and to continue to evolve and improve the system.
Thanks again. And just quickly following up on that again, just wonder if you you and or Brian, you know, remember the first backflip and could share any thoughts of seeing that unfold and if that'll be on your mind as you're watching it tomorrow.
Go ahead.
Well, from my perspective, I'll be sitting on console, of course, watching the crew execute this activity. I was on the space station side for STS 114 as a flight director when this was being executed, and I can't say I'll think too much about that. It was an interesting time, obviously, but right now I'm pretty well focused on the activity at hand and ensuring that the crew gets through this one safely and we get rendezvous and dock safely and everything goes well. Like Leroy did say, we do have learned a great deal in the past couple of few years on how to fly this vehicle and how this vehicle behaves and how to analyze the data on the ground. I'll emphasize what he said. I've gone to a bunch of the mission management team meetings where we have discussed the inspection techniques we have and the analysis techniques we have, and it's pretty astonishing, actually, how far that team has come and how good they are at doing what they do, and I am impressed and amazed each time we get something for them to look at. I'm glad when we don't have something for them to look at, but when they do look at things, they do so in such a thorough and rigorous manner that it is very impressive. So we will do the rendezvous pitch maneuver tomorrow, and everything is going to go well, I expect, and we got the teams backing us up and helping us out when need be otherwise.
Thanks.
Okay, let's see. Irene, are you on the line?
I am. Thanks very much. I just had a quick question about the Soyuz photo rendezvous, if that's approved. The Flight Day 9 schedule, the last one I saw, has the hatches being closed at the end of that day, and I'm assuming that you'd postpone that. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a good assumption. If we insert this extra day to go do this activity, plus we would use the additional time to do additional outfitting of the PMM and also some stowage in the HTV. We had that idea in our minds going into this mission. We may need extra time or want to use extra time for those activities if everything else is going well. In addition, on that extra day on Flight Day 10, so on Flight Day 9, right, we would not close the hatch. We would insert Flight Day 10, and that would essentially, they'd do the flyabout in the morning, get redocked. We'd go do all those other, rest of the folks on board would be doing those other activities during this time period. And then we'd close the hatch the night of Flight Day 10, and then we'd undock the morning of Flight Day 11 and continue with the rest of the mission.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thanks, Irene. Okay, we're back here for any wrap-up. Peter, you have anything while Jeremiah's on your side? Okay, anybody over here other than Mark? I guess we'll let Mark wrap it up.
Thanks, Mark Rowe for Aviation Week, and I believe it's for Leroy. When would the MMT ideally kind of like to clear the TPS for the mission based on the imagery that you get from all the different sources?
It'll be in all likelihood in the Sunday time frame. I think the way the timeline lays out, Mark, we'll get a great bit of our data tomorrow, of course. As Discovery approaches the station, we'll get a lot of the photography. We'll get all those images downlinked. The crew will analyze all of that data. I believe you've heard us talk about our focused inspection meeting, the debris assessment team and the orbiter experts. They have that, I think, at least as of today, they have that set for about 9 o'clock tomorrow night. Saturday evening, so we expect to have the lion's share of the data in hand, at least to the point where they can make a recommendation as to whether or not there's an area that would require some more detail or some focused inspection, as it were. And so that recommendation will come to the MMT as early as Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon, and subsequent to that, things begin to happen pretty rapidly. the remainder of the data comes in pretty quickly, and then the way it gets analyzed and it gets QA'd and it gets peer-reviewed, it'll be in that Sunday, probably not later than Monday timeframe. I think as it relates to the Soyuz fly-around that we're talking about, I'm going to want to have a pretty good understanding of the health of the vehicle before we commit to doing that from a shuttle standpoint, simply because, selfishly, that plus one day, we have a lot of different ways we could use that. And obviously, if there were some thing that we wanted to look more closely at, we might need to use up part of that plus one for a focused inspection kind of opportunity. So I don't anticipate that. When I look at the performance going uphill, when I look at preliminarily how Discovery looks in orbit and the performance of the external tank, I absolutely don't expect that to be any issue. But in any case, we'll go through our normal process, and I expect that to wrap up in the Sunday, Monday timeframe. And then we'll make a decision on Monday, in all likelihood, with about the Soyuz fly around in the MMT. And then as an MMT, IMMT integrated team, we'll make a final decision on Tuesday morning, is the way the timetable lays out now. Now, that assumes everything that we have planned in the next 48 hours goes just as Brian has it laid out. And if it does, then that's kind of what you can expect.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, that'll wrap up the questions. A couple of programming notes for you. Obviously, the crew goes to bed a little before 10 tonight, Central Time. We'll begin showing the Flight Day 2 highlights at 10 o'clock and on the hour through the crew sleep period, which ends with a wake-up call Saturday morning at 5:53 a.m. Central. The R-bar pitch maneuver that Brian described begins just after noon tomorrow, and docking to the station is scheduled for about 1:15, so look for that. Hatches are open just after 3, and then the MMT meets beginning at 1 again tomorrow, and we'll be back here for another status briefing with you at 3:30 Central. Look for all of that on the NASA TV schedule. It's a living document. We update it frequently, so make sure you follow it out there on the web when you get a chance. So with that, we'll thank everybody for coming, and we'll head back to Mission Control and back to space. Thanks.